I'd like to speak today. I was going to speak about one topic, and then I kind of had to change a little bit because I think we need a bit more background before I go into that other topic. So we're not going to get through all this information. This is going to have to be the first part of a series of different talks that we'll talk about. But the first part of this might seem a little bit boring, but then the second part will be a little bit more closer to home, I think. So just bear with me. What are we talking about? We're going to talk a little bit about the importance or the value of our emotions or our feelings and how they fit into why they're important, and what the consequences of not understanding them could be, which is primarily where I kind of started. We'll come back to that idea though. So let's start with St. Thomas. He's always very clear, and he talks about his word that he uses for the emotions is passions. This is so the Prima Secunda, question 24. And he talks about how we share a certain thing with animals. It's something that we have in common with animals, just on a pure sense level. So if we look at it from that point of view, there is no morality in itself for a feeling. Okay? So what is his definition of it? Well, how does he describe a passion or a feeling? He says it's a tendency towards some sensible thing. So the appetite is usually the word that we give it to this philosophically. So we have a tendency towards something. It doesn't have to just do with our appetite for food. That's usually the common understanding of appetite. But when we talk about appetite, it's more this general idea of tending towards something. And when we talk about our senses or our passions, we talk about the tendency towards something sensible. So there's this attraction towards something, and it's accompanied by a change, a certain amount of physiological change in our body. The most common example is you walk into a bakery and you see these nice buns or something and you smell them and you start salivating. Hopefully not like a dog, but you have a sense. So something actually happens in your body that changes, that makes you want to go after and get that thing and eat that thing. And then he gives division between the different kinds of passions. He says there's, I think we've spoken about this before. He says there's concupiscible and then there's irascible passions. Concupiscible, those are the more simple, basic passions. So where you go after the good thing and you avoid the evil thing. So that's those different passions would be love and hate, desire and aversion, pleasure and sadness. So those are like the basic fundamental passions. And then the irascible, those are the more aggressive ones for more, you might say, dangerous or out of the norm situations. So there we have hope and despair, audacity or courage and fear, and then anger. Okay, so remember with all of these, they have no morality in themselves. The morality that's given to them is determined on how we accept them. Now, it's not that black and white though, because of course, just like anything, we don't have any responsibility for anything we do unless it's voluntary. It's something that we choose to do. Okay, that's a basic principle. We're all clear with that. But the problem with emotions, feelings, passions, as St. Thomas calls them, is that we don't, he says, we don't have perfect control over them, so we don't rule over them like a tyrant rules his subjects. He says it's more as a statesman rules his free men. So you don't have a, like in a democratic government, the ruler doesn't have a perfect control over what the people are doing. Obviously, he legislates, or he with the legislative power legislates what should be done. And they decide if somebody's following those rules or not and punishes them or rewards them accordingly. But he doesn't have perfect control over what's happening. He does have a certain amount of control, but he also has to allow for a certain tolerance, you might say, of evil. Okay? So, but the important thing that St. Thomas points out is that our passions, although morally they don't have any value in themselves, they are used to either help or to prevent us from obtaining our ultimate goal. So they do have a very specific and important function, depending upon how we use them and how we accept them or how we reject them. So as I said, these bodily reactions, they're not always subject to the command of our will. But the reactions of depending on how we receive them or if we receive them or not, that's where it does become something voluntary or something involuntary. Now, sometimes these reactions happen so quickly. So what happens is, first our body has some kind of reaction, and then our soul will either accept it or reject it and will react accordingly. Okay, so first, when that first happens, that sensible kind of thing that happens to our body, that's something that we don't often have control over, and that's something that's not there's no morality in that. But then after that, once we accept it or we reject it, depending upon what the situation is, that's where the morality comes into it. Now, sometimes things happen extremely quickly, and you can have one thing follow upon the other extremely quickly. And obviously, if it goes from the body into the soul really quickly, then usually there's no... If it happens extremely quickly, then there is no acceptance of that, so there's no morality of it, unless it's something that is foreseen, that if you're in this place at this time, this is what happens, and you can see the chain of events and it's happened to you before. Okay, then that's a different story. Are you all with me so far? Okay. Now, as St. Thomas, of course, he's first and foremost a philosopher, so as he says, these are lower powers. So the higher powers, as we know, our higher powers are intellect and will, and everything else that happens in our body is subject to that. So when we talk about these passions, they have to be subject to the intellect and the will. Now, they have their own goods that they go after, but that has to be subjected to what we know is the right thing, okay? So, for example... go back to our example of you smell or you see something that's you really want to eat. So the good for the appetite for hunger at that moment is to be satisfied, to go after that thing and to have that. So that's its goal, right? In a very narrow sort of a way. But that has to be subjected overall to seeking out virtue, to living a virtuous life. So if it's not virtuous in that moment to eat that thing, then even though that sense appetite is going after that thing, that's not the right thing to do. Okay, I think this is all basic common sense. I'm not really telling you anything that's new. So these lower powers, they have to be subordinated to the higher powers. Now, they can contribute to a moral act, so they can help a moral act, for example, like you could say, if we stay with our same example of eating, We have to take care of our body. That's part of the fifth commandment. And the pleasure in eating can help you to do that, which usually, you know, it's not that difficult to force somebody to eat. We all want to eat because there is a certain amount of pleasure in eating. And that's why with these basic human functions, which we need for survival, that's why there is a lot of pleasure that's attached with them, because they're easily accessible and we easily come back to them because we need them. Like if it was hard to eat for us, then that would be a bit of a problem, because you could neglect that more easily. So yeah, they can contribute to a moral act. So they can help us to do something that we already have to do, and that's usually how we see them. Or if we're looking at it from a moral point of view, they can also lessen the moral act if the passion precedes too much our will. So meaning it more easily helps us to do something without us actually deciding beforehand to do it or something like that. It's taking some of the, not responsibility, but you might say, the merit, I guess, from it, if we look at it from a supernatural perspective. Okay. That's kind of a small introduction from St. Thomas. And then I'm going to go a little bit into something that's a bit more realistic. So why are our emotions, why are our feelings important? And why we think that they're not important? Maybe I'll put it to you. How do you think emotions are perceived in the world today by the average person you meet on the street?
Think too much about their emotions.
To us.
Like they let their emotions decide everything for them instead of their will. That's like the philosophy of modern life, is do whatever you feel like doing.
Yeah. And that's a theme that's you find in modern music, you find in film, you find in just in modern media in general. That's the kind of that's the message that's pushed across, is go with whatever you feel like. Now, I think what often happens is we see that, especially in the traditional Catholic sphere or world, and we see people tending towards that path, if you will, and so we go to the opposite extreme. And so what we often find in our circles is that these emotions are undervalued because they're overvalued in the world. So you go from one extreme to the other. And this is a common human reaction to difficulties. It's very hard to find that middle ground. So it's much easier to be black and white and to bounce from one extreme to the other. So we often find that. Because especially for us, as traditional Catholics, how have we come to decide or to discern even the Latin Mass? You have to be somewhat intellectual. You have to be somewhat discerning. You have to do your own kind of research. And it's very much of an intellectual thing, even though, of course, grace is always involved, which leads you to the right place. You can't discount that factor. But to a large extent, people that do discover the Latin Mass, it's very much an intellectual kind of a thing. And then you also have this whole idea of rejecting, of being kind of countercultural and rejecting the current stream of thought in the culture that we're living in, because it's not a great culture to live in. So yeah, so you have the tendency to go from one extreme to the other. And I think sometimes we have this idea that emotions, feelings are childish, they're effeminate, they're weak, and we can kind of discount them, bury them, leave them alone, and just go with what we know is right, because that's the right thing. Now, of course, there's a certain amount of truth to that, because they have to be subjected to our higher powers, but you can't completely discount them. And I think the important thing to remember is that God has put them there for a very specific reason, and if we try to ignore them, we're trying to get to our goal leaving them aside, and we're going to have trouble doing that because we're leaving a basic integral part of our human nature aside. And you can't really just do that through brute force. You're going to break eventually in some way or another, which is where we're going to go with this conference. So you need to pay attention to them. You need to see what's happening because they're trying to send you messages. That's ultimately what's happening with your different emotions. And ultimately, if we look at people that are very passionate about something, even the very word that we use, so somebody that's very successful, right? We say usually he gets there because he's very passionate about that thing that he's successful with. So even that is, even the very word that we use to describe him, the adjective we use to describe him, is denoting the fact that he's using in some way his passion to get him where he is. So he's very passionate. And when we use that term, it's not all a negative term. It's actually a very good term, that somebody's passionate about something, unless they're crazy about it, but then they're OCD, then that's like next level. But when we say you're passionate about something, that's good. That's something that's said in a good light. It's not said in a negative light. And also, if you look at the different examples of saints, often what drives them is a certain kind of passion about some kind of aspect in the spiritual life. So, for example, we look at Saint Francis. What he was very passionate about was getting back to the basics of the gospel, and what his focus on was poverty. And that's what he kind of lived out. And it was a response to the materialism that was going on in the world. But for him, that's what he was passionate about. And that's what kind of led him to start the Franciscans. Everybody with me so far? Okay. So I think the point here is that our emotions, they're important not only for survival or for kind of living a fully developed life, but also for a pleasant life. You can't have any kind of basic relationship without having some kind of emotion, of it being on an emotional level. Of course, if it's going to be a very good friendship, it has to be based on shared values. Okay, so what values do you, what things, what principles do you have that you value above anything else, like non-negotiables? That's what you want to base a really good friendship on, if it's friendship of virtue. But if it's going to be a human friendship, which means if it's going to be expressed in a human way, it's going to have an emotional layer to it, because you're going to express that in a different way, and depending upon your temperament and the temperament of that other person and how they relate or they don't relate, you're going to express that in different ways. And that's, you're relying mostly on, that's mostly on the emotional level. Of course, what you're going to be talking about, especially if it's deep friendship, is going to be something much deeper, but how you relate that even is on an emotional level. Because we're not machines. This is kind of a problem when we're living in a technological age, is that you plug something into a machine and it spits something else out, what you want it to spit out. It works great for a machine, but it doesn't work for people. and I think we forget that sometimes when we spend so much time in front of a machine, that always you do this and you plug this thing in and it does what you want it to do. Well, when you try to do that with people, it doesn't really work. And especially when we're living in a society where more and more so, you don't have to meet somebody in person. You can have a Zoom call. So you don't, or you can have a phone call, or you can just have a text, or whatever you're doing nowadays with Snapchat or whatever the latest thing is. You don't have to go and put, like Jordan Peterson even talks about the art of shaking somebody's hand. he says that you make eye contact with a person and you match the person as they're coming out. You match the same speed as they're coming out. And then the way that you squeeze their hand and you don't hang on for too long. It's something that we're completely losing nowadays, because you could just pop onto a Zoom call and you say, hey, hello, how's it going? And off you go. And that's a really important element of our human nature that we're losing. The more Zoom calls that we have and the less in-person meetings we have. So they give, they're necessary for our survival, because if you don't pay attention to them, you try to bury them and then you have all sorts of problems. And then they make you less productive. They make life less pleasant if we don't pay attention to them. And they give less... you get to a point where life seems like it means less if you don't have it. Because it's an integral part of our human nature. If we don't have it, we're not using that, then we're missing a huge part. So we're going to feel like we're missing a meaningful part of our lives, which we are. Okay. Now, before we get to kind of where I want to go with this conference, let's talk a little bit about, now this is just a brief overview. This is taken from a book, an interesting book. It's called Running on Empty by, I think she's a psychologist, Jonice Webb. So some of these ideas are taken from her, just basic ideas of identifying our emotions and why this is important. So she says it's important always to not only to identify emotion, to figure out why you're having that emotion, because the body is trying to send you some kind of message. So this isn't happening in a vacuum. It's not like you have a random emotion telling you to do something random. There is always some kind of connection for it. Now, there could be, sometimes there has to be a certain amount of rewiring because you have a certain emotion and it makes you do something different. It makes you do something, maybe it makes you a bit stressed and it makes you feel like you have to have a cigarette or something like that. Well, then there's a problem there. There's a certain amount of rewiring that has to be done. And we'll come back to that idea. But there's reasons why you have certain feelings. There's reason why you have these different sensible appetites. And so there's a message that's trying to be given to you. So you have to recognize what that is. And the more you try to bury it, the more it's not going to go away. It's still going to be there. And then you have to understand why it's there. So yeah, one example that I have, so this idea of sometimes having certain feelings which seem a bit irrational, but there being a cause for it. I remember my grandmother, she had a daughter who ended up drowning. So it was a bit of a tragic story. My aunt, I think she was only 12 years old or something. And she was swimming with somebody else, and it was actually the other person that didn't know how to swim, and she dragged her down, and the other person ended up living, and she ended up drowning. So it was a tragic story. But anyway, for the rest of her life, like when we were growing up and we were at a pool or something like that, she always had, like she was a bit afraid. Like, so I think there must have been this connection, seeing a child, being near water or swimming in water, and obviously because of certain trauma that she had in her past life, she reacted, you might say, inordinately because of that past trauma. So yeah, awareness is kind of this first step, being aware of what's going on inside of you. This is this old philosophical adage, noshi te ipsum, to know yourself. And part of knowing yourself is also to figure out how you work. Why are you acting a certain way? Why are you drawn to this or that thing in this or that situation? Why are you having such and such a feeling? So try to be aware of what it is that's happening to you rather than just pushing forward or something like that, or burying it underground. Being aware of it, so identifying it. And then she says also just accepting it. The fact that it's there, you can't... you can't try to ignore the fact that it's there because it is there. And this is an important distinction also when we talk about sin and where this consent for sin comes in, when it has to do with thoughts. So sometimes these thoughts will come in your mind for whatever reason it is. Maybe it's past sin, or maybe it's something you saw recently that you didn't actually even look out after or search for. And the important thing, I think, there is that just because you have a temptation, as you know, as this isn't something new for any of you, but just because you have a temptation, even if it's something that's extremely vivid, that doesn't mean you've committed to sin. Because as we said in the beginning, you don't have perfect control over your emotions and these different ideas that come into your mind. It's not a perfect control you have over them. So you can see it, you can recognize it for what it is, but when you get to that point, then whether you accept it or not and you continue with that idea or not, that's where the consent comes into play. But just to see it for what it is not consent in itself. And then she says, so you identify it, you accept it, then you try to attribute it to something. Why is it happening? What's the reason for it happening? And then do you act on it or do you not act on it? Those are her kind of four steps for dealing with emotions. I mean, this is a very, very generic kind of overview of what she talks about, but she says, identify, accept, attribute, and then you act. And then you decide, what do you do with that? Okay. So, the reason why we had that kind of introduction is because I wanted to go and I really wanted to talk about this one main topic, this topic of addiction. Because there's a lot of addiction out there nowadays. There is a lot of addiction. And if each of you were to actually think about this seriously, you probably would find something, even if it's something very small, that you're addicted to. And if you're that exceptional person who's not addicted to something, you probably have people that are close to you in your life that are addicted to some kind of thing. And I think it's extremely important to understand how addictions work, because you can't get rid of addictions just by simply going to the confession or just by simply praying, or sometimes even by changing certain behaviors. That also is not enough to overcome an addiction. So it's kind of a hard thing to pin down unless you understand what's actually happening. And that's why I think it's important that we talk about it and we try to figure out what it is. And there's also a difference between an addiction and an impulsive behavior. We'll come to that. We'll talk about the distinction in a second. But yeah, one of the biggest issues with addictions is that we don't go after the cause of the addiction, but we go after the symptom of the addiction, okay? So let's use a generic example. Somebody has an addiction to eating. So what do you do to try to overcome that addiction? Lock away your food into cabinets and give the key to somebody else or something like that. Don't ever walk into a supermarket or something like that. But it doesn't work because you're not dealing with the problem, the underlying reason why you are doing that addiction in the first place. And often what happens with addictions is if you get rid of the symptom, so that addiction, the material part of that addiction, so if it's food, you get rid of the food part, it very easily transposes to a different thing. You have that with, we'll come back to these ideas, but if you have a problem of addiction, it really easily, if you get rid of one, just the material part of it, it can easily go into something. It always does, in fact, unless you deal with the underlying condition of addiction itself. So we've got to figure out why. That's the reason. You have to figure out the underlying reason. What's the reason why the addiction is there? And it has to be, first and foremost, something that's internal. It's not simply the external part, the external world that you're living in. That can happen locally and remotely for a certain period of time. But if it's a real addiction that's going to last, here's where you have to look inside. And what's central to discovering, or I suppose an important aspect of determining what that addiction is, or why you have that addiction, is you've got to look at your feelings. You have to look at why are your feelings leading to this or that place? Why are your emotions in this kind of a state? Okay, so let's define it. What is an addiction? Everybody's with me still so far? James, you're getting a little tired?
I'm a little tired, but I'm also with you.
Okay, good. All right, addiction. Addiction is a behavior that's intended to reverse a profound, intolerable sense of helplessness. Okay, let me say this again and let it sink, because this is important. It's a behavior that's intended to reverse a profound, intolerable sense of a helplessness. So at the key kind of understanding of addiction, we have to understand this idea of helplessness. You're in some kind of situation, you don't know how to react to it, you feel helpless, and so you react in such and such a way. You don't actually deal with the thing at hand, but you go somewhere else. And where you go is that addiction. Okay? Now, an important thing to understand with this, I'm following this is a book called Breaking Addiction by Lance Dodes, D-O-D-E-S. I don't know where he's from or anything, but somebody gave me the book, and that's what I'll be following for the next couple conferences. So the important thing that he stresses is just because you have an addiction does not mean that you're a fragile person, doesn't mean that you're weak. It simply means that there is, because of these feelings that you haven't, or this trauma or whatever it is that you haven't been able to process, that's how your body is dealing with it, and it's dealing with it in the wrong way. Also, he insists that it's not the same as being as impulsive behavior. We'll come back to that idea. And he says the issues that provoke this addiction are the same as the main emotional troubles that you have in your life. So, in other words, in order to understand these problems of addiction, you have to dig into these misunderstood or unresolved emotions or trauma in your life and figure out why do I act in such and such a way. So, but the key point here to understand is that what is an addiction? An addiction is something that happens because you have this feeling of helplessness. Okay? This is the key point of understanding this. Yes.
Would you say that once the addiction is formed, that the role of helplessness stops, though? And that helplessness sets up the addiction, but it isn't. Once you have the full addiction, it isn't really helplessness anymore.
We'll talk about these ideas more in depth as we move along. But the reason why you feel helpless doesn't mean because you are helpless. Okay? So it's the body telling you that you are helpless, although you're actually not. So you don't know how to deal with a certain situation. He gives a lot of examples in his book. It's well worth a read if you're interested in this idea. I think the first example he gives is, it's kind of a generic example. He gives this example of a guy when he was younger. His parents had a very fraught relationship, and his mother was always asking him for things to do. His father was as well, and his brother wasn't very kind to him as well. So he was kind of being pulled in all directions, and he was trying to please everybody. And of course, you're not going to have a very emotionally stable person if they're being pulled in all these different directions. And then he fast forwards to when he's married, it's later on in his life, and he's at work, it's towards the end of the day, and from the accounting department, they bring this big stack of papers, and he has to sort through all these pieces of papers before the end of the day, or by the end of the day, or something like that. And because he has this history of being pulled in all different directions, he doesn't know how to deal with it. And so he just gets angry. He puts his head down. He does that. And the first thing he does when he leaves is he goes and he gets a drink. Now, Does that mean that that was the only thing that he could have done? No, there are other ways of dealing with the situation. He could have gone to his boss. He could have spoken about it. He could have done it the next morning, maybe, or there could have been a whole bunch of different things that he could have done in order to assert his autonomy in that specific situation. But because of the way that he's rewired, he has this feeling of helplessness, and so off he goes, and he goes for a drink after it. Does that make sense, James?
Yeah.
I mean, we'll come back. He develops this idea more, but that's not so important now. I think the important idea is to understand that you have this feeling of helplessness, so you're looking for a fast solution. You don't know how to deal with the problem at hand, so you go after the addiction. And then you build up this habit of every time this kind of situation happens, these sort of things line up, off you go, and you go after that addiction, because that's your kind of feeling of comfort. That's the only thing that you know to go to in those times of helplessness. Okay, so he says the drive behind this addictive behavior, as we've been saying, is this rage. He calls it a kind of rage at the fact that you feel helpless. He says it's this particular kind of rage that gives this addiction its most conspicuous characteristics of intensity and loss of control. So rage gives it, it's because it becomes very intense. Somebody that is addicted literally doesn't have control over what they're doing, because if they're really far into that addiction, if they're deep into that addiction, once they come to this idea of, or this what might you say, this specific incident of helplessness, it's very intense. It's a bit like when you're overcome with some kind of emotion like anger. If you've ever seen or come across somebody who is extremely angry, they don't have control over what they're doing or what they're saying. It's just all rage. So that's why he talks about this kind of rage at helplessness. They're angry at the situation, they're angry at themselves, they're angry just at everything and everybody. They don't know what to do, they feel helpless, and so they're trying to go and come up with a solution. Now, he also he highlights this idea that it's not so from somebody who doesn't have the addiction looking at somebody who has the addiction, it seems very self-destructive, right? Like if we go back to our eating disorder, every time somebody gets frustrated, they go into the pantry and they just gorge themselves on a whole bag of crisps, and they eat whatever's in the fridge and that sort of thing. Like, it seems like it's self-destructive and it's ridiculous. But he says it's not self-destructive because the person feels trapped and overwhelmed and they don't know what to do. And the example that he gives is if you were in a cave, like caves we were in Donegal, and you became trapped in that cave. Let's say it was even a smaller cave. How would you react in that situation, Breed? Yeah. Exactly. And you'd probably claw at the entrance and try to force yourself on your way out. Of course, the better thing to do there is to remain calm, to look around, see what you can do. But you get claustrophobic. What do? You start pushing around, you start yelling, have you ever read that book called, and there's also a film on it called Unbroken? And there's three guys, they're in this, I don't know, B-something 52 bomber, whatever the heck it is, I know nothing about planes. So there's a whole crew of guys, three of them survive, they're on the raft, they get to the raft, right? Two of the guys are pretty level-headed, and one of the guys is just panicking, right? And they have, on the raft, they do actually have some food. They have like a few chocolate bars and a few like biscuits or something like that. And so they sit down and they say, okay, this is what we're gonna do. One person is gonna keep watch, and the other people are gonna sleep, and we're gonna take turns and have rotation. And we're going to ration out the food so that we try to survive for as long as we can. And what happens, Johnny? Do you remember? Yeah. So while the two are asleep, the man that was panicking, he opens up the rations and he eats everything. So was he doing something that was self-destructive? No, he wasn't thinking. He was doing something that he was trying to survive for him. His brain was so fogged, that was the only thing for him that he thought was the reasonable thing to do. So he did it. And surely afterwards he regretted it, especially when the other two were yelling at him, giving out to him. But oddly enough, this is the weird thing. Like, if, I don't know if it's in the movie, but it's in the book. The only people that survive are the two and not the one that goes after the rations. Which means it all has to do with here. It had nothing to do with, I mean, obviously if you stay for a really long time without food, you eventually just die and waste away. But it had to do with up here. He freaked out and he ended up dying first. Well, he ended up dying, the other two ended up living. Very interesting, interesting book. Highly recommended if you're looking for an interesting read. So going back to this idea, you feel trapped, you feel overwhelmed, just like the poor man that ate all the food on the raft. Okay, so then he talks about specific forms of addiction. Now, he doesn't give a lot of time to this because for him it's kind of an unimportant question. So what addiction do you decide to go after? I'm just worried about the time here. Right, we'll try to wrap up in the next few minutes. What addiction do you go after? He says, it doesn't really matter because the psychology and the understanding of addictions, it's all the same. It's a substitute or it's a displaced action. So you're not facing the thing head on, you're not dealing with the thing, but you're doing something else. He says a more direct response to feelings of helplessness in a particular situation. The choice is somewhat irrelevant. So you can end up with a bad addiction because maybe this thing is more accessible for you in this place and time, or maybe you have certain colleagues who have the same addiction, so you end up getting hooked on drugs because your colleagues smoke marijuana or something like that too. But he says it's kind of irrelevant. But this idea of displacement is the integral part of addiction that you have to understand is. Somebody feels trapped, overwhelmed, they feel immersed in that trap, and so they feel like the only solution is this place of comfort that they go to. But he says the positive side of things, the important thing to remember that because addiction is a coping mechanism for yourself, so something that's happening in here, again, as we said, what's happening outwardly is kind of irrelevant because you have to address the internal first. But he says, the important thing to remember is that because it's from here, once you know those key issues, then you can manage to end that behavior. That's like half of it. It's like when you have a problem, half or maybe even more than half of it is putting your finger on what that problem is, right? Say you have an old building like a church and you have a leak somewhere, and you don't know why the leak is happening. So once you find out where that leak is happening, that's more than 50% of the problem because now, okay, the rest is easy. It's there. You put your finger on it. Now you just have to fix it. But sometimes half of it is trying to figure out, okay, why is the paint leaking or why is the paint chipping here in this spot? There's no apparent leak out there. And old buildings can be a nightmare if anybody's ever dealt with old buildings. But once you figure out what's the cause, you put your finger on it, okay, that's more than 50% of it. All right, we're going to end on this last idea. Where is this? And this is his first step, which he calls, do I have an addiction? That's the first thing you have to figure out. Do you have an addiction, right? Are you suffering from an addiction? Okay, so when does the addictive thought or actor thought arise? You got to try to pinpoint. So, do you have an addiction? Is there something that you cope with when you have these kind of feelings of helplessness or these times where you feel trapped? Or the only thing to go to, it could be as simple as scrolling on social media or Instagram or something like that. That could be an addiction. Think about it. When you feel like this, Maybe you've been insulted. Maybe you've had a bad day at school. Maybe you, your girlfriend or boyfriend didn't call you or spend as much time with you as they should have. What do? Instagram. Feels good for a little while, but feels terrible after a few minutes or after an hour or whatever it is. But that could be a way that you cope with it. And it could be a real addiction. So when you feel helpless, used, ignored, insulted, what are you going to certain things to escape from it? That's what it is. It's a kind of escape. It's even though it's not really an escape. Okay, so first he talks about things, because we've got to make a distinction between addictions and things that might seem like addictions but aren't addictions. And he makes some important distinctions here. First, he says certain habits, which we would call vices, you have to distinguish between a bad habit and an addiction. This is usually something that's linked with familiar situations in a familiar time. This usually happens. You do such and such a thing, like a bachelor. He does such and such a thing. He does it every day. He does it all the time. And he's very used to it. And if you upset the balance of what the normal things he does, then the whole world falls apart. He's not addicted to his routine. He's just very used to it. That's what he does. And just leave him alone. So one example he gives is coffee. Is coffee an addiction? Coffee's not really an addiction. We talk about having addictions to coffee, but it's not really an addiction in the proper medical term of addiction. Why not? Because you wake up, you do your thing in the morning, and then you have a cup of coffee at, say, 8:30 in the morning. Every day, at 8:30 in the morning, you have your cup of coffee, right? And then maybe later on, after lunch at 1:00, you have another cup of coffee every single day. So what happens if you try to go a day without having a cup of coffee at 8:30 in the morning? You have headaches and like you don't know how to function and it's terrible. It's like going through hell. But it's not an addiction because you're not going to that thing when you're in a bad place. That's just what you do every day. Okay? Yes.
Make a distinction then potentially between like a medical
addiction. Yes. We'll come back to that. We'll come back to that idea. That's actually the next one. That's the physical addiction. That's the next thing we'll talk about. So more bad habits or even good habits. If you try to change them, you could say it feels like a certain kind of addiction, but usually it's a habit and you can overcome it by reasoning things out and by sticking to certain resolutions. You can overcome it, okay? You can shed the habit. He says initially you can encounter resistance, but you're able to stop it when you're presented with sensible reasons and you can persevere over time. Okay, now, what you're talking about, this is the next thing, physical addiction. So this is, and there's a bit of overlap with the coffee example, because you could talk a little bit about physical addiction too here. But here we're talking a little bit more about something like a harder drug. Like, yeah, caffeine's a kind of a drug, but it's a very soft drug. So if you talk about, and he gives an example here. So if you get hooked on a certain drug, you have a physical dependence on that substance, okay? So you're going through like even cigarettes, right? You go through a certain amount of the day and you need to have your nicotine. So you have a physical dependence. Is it an addiction? No, not per se, because maybe the person is physically dependent and also has an addiction to cigarettes. That could be. But in itself, because you have a physical kind of addiction to it, doesn't mean you also have addiction in the proper medical sense. Does that make sense? No? Yes?
Yes.
You don't really know. I didn't make a good distinction. Okay, let me clarify. So let me ask you, what is an addiction? How do we define what an addiction is? Yeah, you have this feeling of absolute and utter helplessness. You don't know what to do. So at that point, that's when you go off to do this bad habit. So the two things are linked. You have this feeling of helplessness. And then because of that, how do you cope with it? It's a coping mechanism. You cope with it by going to this thing. Okay, is that clear? But when we talk about a physical dependence on something, that means your body is just used to it. You smoke a cigarette every morning, or you would almost say it with coffee too, because coffee is a kind of a drug, and so your body just gets shaky if you don't have it, right? Or if you're stuck on a worse drug, like heroin or something like that, you don't have the drug, you're physically dependent on it. Now, if it's only a physical dependence, obviously there's going to be a certain amount of withdrawal when you get off this drug, okay? So something as simple as cigarettes. You stop having cigarettes, and then you get a bit shaky. I don't know what happens, whatever. Like, you gain a little bit of weight, and you feel sorry for yourself, or you feel very tired, or whatever it might be. Your metabolism slows down. So your body is detoxing, and so it goes through kind of a, like, what are you doing to me? I need my cigarette, okay? So your body has a dependence on it, but you're not going to it because you're going through something difficult psychologically, necessarily. Although the two, you could have the two together. And I'll give you an example of that. He gives the example of veterans in Vietnam. When they were all in Vietnam, a good percentage of them started using heroin because it was available. You were away from home. There's a lot of trauma that's happening there. And it was something to do. Everybody was doing it. Okay. At the same time, contemporaneous with that, back in the States, the normal civilian, there was this kind of epidemic of people getting hooked on heroin at the same time. Okay? War in Vietnam ended. Soldiers came back home. When they came back home, over 90% of them just stopped smoking heroin or stopped doing heroin because it wasn't as available. They were no longer over there, so they just didn't do it. Whereas the civilians who were doing heroin were still addicted to it because they were actually medically addicted to it, whereas the soldiers were just doing it because it was available, it was something everybody was doing. And obviously when they came home, they had to have a certain amount of detox, so they had to go through a couple weeks of hell or whatever, but heroin wasn't there, it was there if they really looked, but they didn't really want it, they were just doing it in Vietnam because everybody else was doing it. But when they came back, it wasn't available, they stopped. No real big issue there. Does that make sense, Tomas? Okay. I thought that was a good example he gave.
You can have both, though.
Yes, so you can have both. You can have somebody. Say you're in the bad crowd, in a bad crowd, right? And everybody's doing heroin in that crowd. And contemporaneous with that, you're going through a very difficult part in your life personally. Okay, so you end up with this crowd, they're doing heroin, you end up doing heroin too, and you find that it's a great coping mechanism when you're not feeling very well in your normal life. So then, yeah, you have a physical dependence, but you also have an actual addiction to this drug. Does that make sense? A little bit clearer there? Okay. Another important point that he makes, which we made before, is that a proof that you're an addict also is when you regularly switch from a non-drug to a drug substance. So somebody that has maybe a food addiction or something like that, or no, say somebody has an addiction to heroin, and they overcome that heroin addiction, but he even gives an example of this. I forget which example it is, but somebody that was addicted to heroin, she got off heroin, and then she ended up getting addicted to food because she still had the addiction. That was the underlying theme. It was still there, and she just went from one addiction to another. Even though she did the detox from the drug substance, she was still addicted. She still had this addiction. Okay, and then just as a way of distinguishing between other behaviors, he says there can be certain behaviors that mask as addictions but aren't actually addictions, although they can also be present with real addictions. So, but if it's just this alone, he says, he gives three different examples. So relationship pressure, you're with the crowd where every weekend they go out drinking, and then they also smoke marijuana and they pass around the joint and you end up doing it once in a while or something with them. I'm not saying that's okay to smoke marijuana, don't get me wrong, but that doesn't mean that you're necessarily addicted to it. Maybe you're just, whenever you hang out with that crowd, you end up doing smoking marijuana because they're just the wrong crowd to hang out with because you feel pressured to do it. So the obvious thing there is just get away from them. Just cut off ties with them. Also, you can be in special settings where when you're in that setting, you feel you have addictive kind of behavioral actions. And the example he gives is a casino. I've never been in a casino, but apparently when you go into a casino, there's no clocks on the walls. There's no windows yet, no clocks, no windows, and every way that it's designed is for you to spend more money, even if you start winning, just spend all that money. So,
free food and drink always.
Yeah, that was another thing. Free drink. Yeah, he said that too.
Lights
are flashing. He mentioned that too. Yeah.
It's very hard.
How do you guys know so much about casinos?
Hard to find the exit.
Hard to find the exit. In the States, they have these places called Indian reservations, and it's like an independent state, like within a state. It's a bit weird, but basically it's because we treated the Indians so terribly, we felt bad for them, so we given them a little plot of land. And they don't really have, I mean, I don't really know what it is, but they can get away with doing some things that you can't in the rest of the state. So one of the things they do is they have casinos, because like in the state of New York, you can't gamble. But if you go into the Indian reservation, you can actually gamble. So my sister actually went there. What? Did you make a racist comment?
Fair share.
I said it's like a holding site.
Right. So yeah, just a funny side story. There's one up north where my sister was living in northern New York, and they went to a slot machine, which you never do. Don't ever go to a slot machine because you're always going to lose at a slot machine because it's just a computer. You're not playing against real people. Wow. I don't know why I'm giving you advice about casinos, but anyway. So they went to the slot machine. They put in like $1 and they got like $100 back. And then they like looked around. They took the money. And they just ran. So that's the thing to do if you win money at a... just don't go to a casino altogether. You're better off not going. Right. Another behavior masking that looks like an addiction, he says, can be like this period of adolescence or where you're kind of changing from, you're trying to figure out who you are, you're trying different things, and maybe it might seem like this a person is addicted to this or such and such a thing, but it could just be that maybe they're a bit rebellious or trying to figure out who they are, that sort of thing. Okay. I'm going to leave it there because I think I've spoken enough about addictions, and we'll have to continue it because I think it's an interesting kind of and useful kind of conversation.